first cases when we were doing the antelope and the Amistad case, she was telling me it actually relates a lot to some of the research and writing she's been doing. So she's going to just tell us, like, just 2 minutes about some of the work that she's doing.
Yeah, thank you.
I think
some of you already know that I have a book on the market. The title is Customary Law and Slavery in West Africa. So what it is that at some point in my life, and I thank Professor Oledu for letting me do this. So at some point in my life, perhaps because of my background, my travel and my training, I felt the need to explore customary law in West Africa and possible connection with the concept of slavery. And then I came to two conclusions, and that one, West Africa in the traditional system, legal system, is an old one, but they have a different definition of slavery. But then you cannot understand the concept of slavery without exploring also its tie to religion and the land. And the land, not property, but access to the land. So these three concepts are linked together, and it gives you a different perspective on the use of land, right to land, which is tied to Professor Arika. So that's all I have to say.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, well, thank you. With all of these things is that the stories are always more complicated. That, you know, it's always a strange thing we do here in law school, or actually like almost in any discipline, where you kind of divide things up and we say this is contract and this is property and this is con law, and if you want to study like social sciences, you got to go to another building, and economics, that's a different department, where we see actually, you know, we can hear a little bit from Rosalie's story that the stories are all tied together, right? Religion, power, property. So we kind of we've seen that already from the class, but it's a nice reminder. All right, so let's see some announcements. Okay, so the assignment, I've already got a couple of questions come in, and if those of you have been paying attention, I have posted responses both on the Facebook page and on the course website. So, and that's what I'll continue to do. I will probably, you know, every couple of people who email me, I don't have any more outstanding questions, but I hope it's all pretty straightforward. Some of the questions were very specific, like, you know, what email address should I use? I don't care. But I think that I hope that everybody understands that the things that you actually learn in your research and writing class, we have to keep using them all the time, not just in that class, right? So you're still in some ways might be thinking about, do you guys IRAC or CREAC? CREAC? What is CREAC? Oh, interesting.
When I went to law school, it's just IRAC. They added some letters, I guess.
Okay, so the idea is whatever acronym you use, and I don't, it's even not even, I think the acronym or the order is helpful for organizing your thoughts, but I don't even require that, but it is quite common that people tell me the rule and the conclusion, and they forget the analysis part. And the analysis part is really the most important thing, right? That's what you're learning how to do. I'm great to spot an issue. But if you're like, you know, there's four elements to this law, A, B, C, and D, and because we succeed on A and B, we've won, that's just not enough, right? You need to explain what A, B, C, and D mean. You have to take your facts from your situation and apply them to them. I think this is... It all seems logical, but I often get people skipping over that stuff. So I just wanted to remind you. And other than that, I'm happy to kind of keep entertaining any questions. I'll answer them as quickly as I can. Let's see, what else can I tell you? Beef Hilp auction, people going? No, not very few nods there. Not so enthusiastic. Yes, no. All right, so Professor Tausig and I are donating a night out of bowling with us.
Yes.
I just want you to, like, think about it now so you can start finding the four or five people that you want to, like, go in with to go. He's, I think, a good bowler. He's at least a crazy bowler, I believe, which is easy to envision, right?
Not surprising.
I own a surprising number of bowling shirts and yet have very little ability to bowl. So I won't be putting any money on the game. And some shawls that I've made in case you need something for your grandma, I guess. Wait, Jesse, you're a knitter, right?
Yes.
Are you donating anything?
No, I haven't made and finished anything.
You haven't finished anything?
I have like six projects started.
Oh, yes. Welcome to law school. All right. I use faculty meetings to get my knitting done. No, they all know, obviously. Okay, all right, so we're going to finish up our discussion of adverse possession today. Last time we went over the reasons for adverse possession, kind of talked about the background policies that paved the way for it. We went through the basic elements of adverse possession. And we have just two more cases that I want to finish up. And the the first one is continuing our discussion of the hostility element of adverse possession. That in some ways it seems like the easiest element, and sometimes it feels like the most complicated element, depending on... Excuse me. Depending on the state we're in or the court's view of it. Right, so one way we can look at hostility is just saying you are the person that is asserting ownership and that you believe you are the owner. And then hostility doesn't have any aggressive feeling to it, even though we think of that word as being an aggressive word normally. You don't actually have to be like coming to blows with the person who you're claiming ownership of their land. You just have to be saying, I am the landowner. I am acting as though this is mine. I am not here with permission. I am not here because somebody told me that please come and use my yard. I am here because I am stating this is my yard. And we see that in some states, you have to do so with a good faith belief that it really is your yard, right? Like you kind of thought that it was yours. You didn't realize where the boundary lines were, or somebody, you bought a deed off a guy, shady guy in the corner, and somehow thought it was legitimate, right? So some states are going to require that you actually believe the land is yours, and we say that that's a good faith belief. Other states, and this is by far the minority of states, require a bad faith belief. Right? They require you to actually say, I know this land isn't mine. I totally know it belongs to my neighbor. But he is not paying attention, and I'm going to slowly take it over and make it mine. I know I don't have title to it. Now, because it is sometimes challenging to figure out exactly what the adverse possessor's state of mind was, and because we have to rely on that for that evidence, many states have done away with either the good faith or bad faith belief. And they said, we don't really care what that adverse possessor was thinking. All we care is whether or not they held themselves out as being the owner of the land and acted like the landowner in that way and thinking that it wasn't permissive. That it can get complicated, though, because states, have adopted different presumptions. So if we remember when we read that case that was about the church, right? The church opened up on like a counter empty building on Liz, and we're going to make a church there. That court assumed that any type of action like that was, they just assumed that the landowner was giving you permission. They needed they adopted a bad faith belief, or even if it was objective, they kind of adopted a very hard standard. They put it in terms of bad faith, but even if it had been an objective standard, they put a very heavy burden on the adverse possessor to show that they were not there with permission. If you are there with permission, it's never hostile. That always just ruins the hostility if somebody's like, oh, join. Yeah. So what we're going to look to now is another court that was dealing with a similar issue, trying to figure out exactly how do we navigate how stringent of a standard we're going to put on this hostility requirement. Okay, so let's look at Tioga Cole versus Supermarkets General. Zach Alstrom? Yeah. All right, Zach, can you help us with this one? What are the kind of basic facts in this case?
So, Tioga Cole was using a street that was originally supposed to be owned by the city, I believe, and it turns out that it was owned by the H&M supermarket, and they took control of the gate, which controlled the ingress and egress of the street, and then it turns out that the supermarket was the owner. I'm not sure how that actually happened.
Well, that's a great start. Okay, so this is what we call a paper street. If people ever seen that phrase before, not an important one. It's just something that, like, on the maps and on the plans for the area, they had designated that it was going to be a street, and it never actually ended up being built as a street. So then it becomes just kind of this. It's not a public street. It's just this alleyway. Because it was designated as a public street, I think it's not shocking that Tioga Cole assumed that the city actually owned it. But as Zach tells us, upon a further title search, they were wrong, and they learned that it was owned by the neighborhood supermarket, the neighboring supermarket. Okay, so there's a rough drawing of it, right? So we see in blue is the coal company's land, and then we see in red is the grocery store. And there's this like little purple strip, a little basically an alleyway between these two businesses. And as Zach told us, what Tioga did is they put up a gate on that alleyway so that they actually are the ones who are kind of controlling who's coming and going. All right, so Zach, walk us through the elements of adverse possession.
So the first one would be actual.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actual because they're in control of the gate and they were using it every day.
Right, and remember, when we think about actual, we also want to think about, are they using this alleyway in a way that a reasonable owner would? Absolutely, this is like an alleyway, they're using it, their truck's coming and going. Okay, what's next?
And open and notorious, that's pretty obvious that they're using it every day.
Yeah.
And it's adjacent to the supermarket. Everyone's seeing them use it.
Yeah, they have a gate up, right? It very much looks like them. What else?
Then the hostility requirement was a little different in this case than what we've seen. The court focused on the other elements and said that if all these elements are present and they're using it against the title of the true owner, that their state of mind should be irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Their intent is almost irrelevant.
Okay, so the trial court here, wait, I think of it. Here's actually an actual picture of the place, right? So the trial court here said, this does not meet the hostility requirement. Why, Zach? Why did they say this was not hostile?
Because they, Tioga Cole, thought that the street was owned by the city.
Right. They were wrong about who the landowner was. So now we see, if we were in a good faith jurisdiction, they wouldn't win, right? Because they never thought they were the landowner. They thought the city was the landowner. So they wouldn't prevail in a good faith. Do they prevail in a bad faith jurisdiction? I don't know, right? It depends on how specific we need the thought within that adverse possessive intent. Is it bad faith just to say, I know I'm not the landowner and I'm asserting ownership? Or do you have to know who the landowner is and say, I know that the city is the landowner, and I'm asserting that I own it but the city. That's the court said. That said, whether we take an objective or bad faith idea, you have to be asserting ownership. You have to know who the real owner is and assert ownership against them. So this is what the trial court says. Now, why is the appeals court have trouble with that standard?
They say if they're using it, you know, against, or they're taking possession of it, and they know that it's not, they're not the actual owner of the land, and they meet all the other elements, that it's inconceivable that their use of the land is not hostile.
Right. What is our purpose for having adverse possession? If we think about kind of our policy reasons, how do our policy reasons kind of support either the trial court's interpretation or this, the appellate court's interpretation?
For the appellate court's interpretation, it would just be efficient use of the land. Tioga Cole is using the land more efficiently than, say, Tioga Supermarket is not even using it, or not Tioga Supermarket is not even using it. So, as far as for the trial court, I would say that policy reasons, it's almost like they're commandeering the land from supermarkets without their permission.
Yeah, I think that we have something here. I think maybe the trial court's not a big fan of adverse possession. Because they're finding a very... If we follow the trial court's reasoning, we get a very narrow window of places where we're going to allow adverse possession. They're saying good faith isn't going to work because you have to know who the landowner is and assert it against them. So if you think you're the landowner, that's not going to work under the trial court's ruling. Bad faith only works if you are in bad faith and you know who the landowner is. Now remember some of our earlier cases. We had quite a few where we did not know who the underlying landowner was. Right, remember that one with the where they walked across the land and there was Charlie's house and the neighbors were fighting? Right, we have no idea who the underlying landowner was. That's why it had to be kind of the bank took it over. That's often the case with adverse possessors, right? That's the whole point, is that you've got this land lying there idle because no landowner has come forward to use it. So if we now make a state, where the rule is that you have to be in bad faith and know who the landowner is, that's a very narrow world of adverse possession claims that are going to be found acceptable. Now, not everybody likes the concept of adverse possession. Right, what do you guys think? Makes sense to you? Everybody likes it? Nobody's kind of bugged by this idea? You all love it. Oh, it's so unusual. Charlie?
I mean, keeping with like the general rule that you want to economically use land and develop it, you have to have adverse possession. Because if somebody's not using land, not taking care of it, not monitoring to make sure that you're not there, why should they have the land to begin with if you're not developing it?
But, you know, if they paid for the land and they have title to the land, they don't have the right to just, like, leave it sitting there?
I mean, they may have the right, but if you're, you know, like, maybe a development of society philosophy, you don't believe that that should prevent someone from developing.
Arthur?
I mean, like how the book says, like, back in the past, when everything was just wide open land and they wanted to develop it. Today, with, like, most people live in like urban society, so like if you buy land somewhere and just want a pristine area to go, you don't have to worry about people just coming and building a cabin on being like, oh, it's mine now, I'm claiming this. I mean, you might just want something that's peaceful and that's what you want to do with the land.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, to some landowners, it's a very surprising rule to learn that, particularly in some states where the statute of limitations is only 5 years, right, that you could, you know, let's say you're in law school and you have inherited land from, like, your great aunt, and you're busy. You haven't gotten out there and done anything with it, but you fully intend to one day, you know, like, build a cabin out there or something, but you don't go out and look at it every year. You don't go and inspect the land periodically. You don't go in each season of the year to make sure it's not being used either in winter or summer. And then you lose your land because you haven't been a diligent landowner. I think we could see, I hope we can see both arguments here, right? So you can see why what we might have going on here with this trial court opinion is somebody who's just not crazy about the idea of adverse possession. Like, maybe it just doesn't make sense anymore, especially because a lot of adverse possession grew up when we had really messy titles. And although titles are still messy, they're a lot better than they used to be, right? You can still kind of go to a land recording office and find out who the owner is and buy it from them. The story used to be, it would be you couldn't figure out who owned it, so you wouldn't even know who to buy it from. We just don't have those same scenarios anymore. Allie?
It bothers me that I could have, like I grew up on 15 acres of land. Like, it bothers me that somebody can move into the back part of my backyard that, like, I don't know about. Because I'm not walking through heavily wooded areas to go, like, see if anybody's back there. Like, I have hunters on my land all the time because I live in the mountains, but I wouldn't expect those people to be able to, like, take that land. Especially in, like, nowadays where I feel like a lot of people are, like, consciously thinking about preserving the environment, especially in areas where it hasn't been, like, urbanized or developed at all. I don't understand why I can't just own a parcel of land and, like, let nature be nature.
Well, you know, so you can, but obviously you have to, like, you have to let, you can let nature be nature, But you still got to go and make sure it's being nature and that nobody else is kind of coming. And there are other mechanisms that we'll see later in the class. There's kind of restrictions you could put on your land that would prevent it from happening. We know that, I hope people notice this point, right, there's no adverse possession against the government, so perhaps if you really want area to remain a nature preserve, the best thing to do is, you know, try and get your local government to be a co-owner or something with you. I mean, there's like mechanisms you can do, but they're all mechanisms for people who are pretty sophisticated and aware of this being a problem. And I think a lot of landowners are surprised to learn that this is even something they can do. Right, so if we remember the Steinberg Homes case, the Jacques family, that wasn't an adverse possession case, but we can see in that case that they are so nervous about their land because they were surprised, because they had somebody a few years earlier who got part of their land through adverse possession. Then, and to them that was kind of a shocking element of the law that they didn't know. So we have all of these policy reasons that we talk about of why we have adverse possession, but we have to couple that with the idea that to some places, to some jurists, like those policy reasons are fading. And they may be less kind of sympathetic with some of the traditional claims. Christian?
Is there a tension between the right to exclude and adverse possession?
Absolutely, absolutely, right? This is why these cases, this is why when we started adverse possession, I said it's kind of crazy. We just had this case with, like, you cannot step foot on my land, even if you do no damage to it, otherwise you are a trespasser. And now I'm going to follow it up and teach you guys that, or if you do it enough, you can just become a landowner. Right? It is a big tension, right? That's why I say it's kind of all these sticks we talk about in the bundle are all these different property rights you have. There's ways all of them can be diminished. And so the right to exclude, absolutely. If you don't stop those trespassers enough, you can lose rights to your land.
How does receivership relate to adverse possession? Because I adverse possession, it really bothers me. I worked as a real estate paralegal, so I can go online and find out what property. So I don't see any reason for someone to claim they don't know who owns property. But if there's an apartment building that's falling down, now the government can take it and give it to someone else and fix it up. So I think that kind of solves the problem of the land not being used well, while protecting the kind of rural nature land.
So some people argue that instead of allowing things like adverse possession, we should have more aggressive use of eminent domain, which we'll study later in the semester, but I think some of you probably heard of this concept already. But this idea that the government entity should be able to come in and take over property. So perhaps you're right, Ben, if we have an empty, vacant building in a place like there where there's a housing shortage and there's a need for maybe it would make a lot of sense for society if the government came in and took over that building and we could solve some of those problems. That is a totally different process. It's just as hard. It's expensive. Then we have to consider whether adverse possessor, that's one person kind of using the cost. You know, one person, one landowner. The eminent domain is spreading the costs over society. Well, it's just a different equation, and a lot of people do advocate like this is not, we shouldn't be doing kind of these private kind of aggressive property takeovers. We should be making more kind of sound public policy using those types of tools.
And the one experience I had, the landowner kept the land, but they had to pay, and it acted like a farm. So someone got put in charge of managing the property and fixing it up, filling potholes and making sure it's on the code. And then the kind of owner who was in New York City had to pay off the bills. So they kept the land, as well with me, but they had to kind of take their responsibility.
So we can think about it a little bit when we get to the context of landlord-tenant, but it is a mechanism that people have used. Like a receivership or rules about, you know, absentee landlords or slumlords. There are different mechanisms we use all the time to try and solve some of the things that we see as problems rooted from that. And we'll see that a little bit in landlord tenant. I do think it's a particular example that doesn't really apply kind of if we're just thinking about the more common adverse possession discussions, which are more, tend to be more rural or suburban. All right, let's, we went through these. Oh, we forgot exclusives. Exclusive, Zach?
Yeah, I mean, they had a gate.
They had a gate, right? They weren't. It wasn't like they were. It would be non-exclusive if they opened it up and everybody used that alleyway, or if the supermarket also used the alleyway, that type of thing. Hira?
Can the government take property via adverse possession? Since That's an excellent question. I don't see why not, but I can think of no example. Yeah, they absolutely should be able to. If they can meet all of these elements, I don't... I'd be hard-pressed. I think a government entity would be very hesitant to do so just because of the political backlash against it and it looking like a Fifth Amendment takings, but which we also will get to at the end of the semester. But there is no policy or law. In the same way, there is a clear policy reasons and clear law in every state that we do not allow adverse possession against property owned by the government. But I've never seen anything that says it the opposite way. Interesting. A fun, student note you could write. All right, let's do Howard B. Pinto. Dang it. I always have plans, and then they're not here. At least, excellent. All right. Lauren, how about you? You want to help us out here?
Yeah.
She's excited to do so.
Actually not, because I don't have my notes from last class, because I thought we finished up the class.
Because you thought that I would, actually be on schedule?
No.
All right, no.
I can do the next page for you for today.
I got plans for that. I have very weird strategies for who goes. It's like, oh, makes no sense to you guys. Okay. Amanda, how about you? Can you do Howard B. Pinto?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there are two companies on Instagram, and they thought that they owned certain ones, the Wolfen Images. And it turns out that they actually owned the Jesus plots, and it caused problems. So they're trying to adversely claim the plots that they were actually.
How did this happen?
There was a problem with the surveying of the land and miscommunication.
Yeah, and like a long time ago. So this is like, I only some days get pointers, I guess. Okay, but we can see the idea here, right? Is there's a row of lots, and everybody's house is actually sitting on their neighbor's land, right? Everybody's offset by one, right? So if you own a house, we can see, right, that the Kuto house there is on lot B, but their deed is actually for lot A, right? Everybody just got upset. Happened a long time ago, and then the land has, some of the land has been remaining the same families, but a lot of the parcels have been changing hands over time, right? And so we also see in here one of the first justifications, and one of the ones that we all felt the best about for adverse possession, just the idea of cleaning up deeds, cleaning up these mistakes in the record. Right, so this one doesn't feel kind of as... Al, you're not as worried about this example, I'm guessing, right? Nobody's actually... should be losing their land. Everybody's deeds should just be shifting around. We're just going to clean up the records. All right. So... Oh, yeah, that's just another map of the same thing. And here's a pretty picture. Also, I want you to realize how nice this land is and show actually why this is very desirable real estate. And also to understand a little bit about the really sketchy thing that is going on here. Do you understand, Amanda, why the land claim he's trying to make is a little bit sketchy?
Yeah, because one of them just moved in, he's only been there for a year.
That's the struggle with the adverse possession claim, right? That's where we're going to run into trouble right now. We're going to run into trouble with the continuous for the statutory period. The facts of this case look like something we think a bunch of neighbors could sit down and negotiate and figure out. You guys all have the wrong deed. Let's all just correct our deeds, and we'll all kind of do this through kind of mechanisms we've talked about before, like the quit claim deeds and the quiet title actions and stuff like that. So they should be able to clean that up. But one of the landowners has realized that he might be able to use this to get more land. So so the Howard's land, which is this like tan color here next to the park, has the Moyer's house on it. And what Howard does is he gives the Moyer's deed to the land that is where their house is in exchange for getting their deed. So now Howard has not only his land minus what he's given to the Moyers, he now has the deed to the pink area where the Kuntos house is.
So he believes if he can get that land as well, right, he's going to actually have quite a large parcel here with just like the Moyers house in the middle of it. So in some ways, he's hoping for a little bit of a windfall here. And that's why we, a lot of times, this is not the first time this has happened that all the deeds have been offset. Usually people just kind of fix that. This is why this is even a court case. All right. Okay, so all of these people, though, are claiming, can make a claim versus adverse possession. All right, so let's go through the elements, Amanda.
Well, actual is true because they have been residing on it for a long time. Open and notorious, I mean, it's very obvious who lives there. They're exclusively using it. I guess hostility would be the question because it isn't obvious that they thought they owned it when they actually did.
Right, so it depends a little bit on what type of jurisdiction we're in. Can you tell whether this is good faith or bad faith or neither, or just kind of objective? Well, how would you describe them first? Would you describe these claimants as good faith, bad faith?
Good faith,
right? They totally believe that this was their land, that they held title to it. Does the court make it clear whether or not this is a good faith, bad faith, or objective test here?
Yeah, they talk about the difference between a squatter or a trespasser. And I think it's better than the last case. So.
That's all right. I don't think it's actually entirely clear. Like, the description of them portrays them as a good faith claimant, but we don't have a clear statement, I think, from this court of whether bad faith claimant wouldn't be legitimate as well. So we're either in a good faith or an objective standard jurisdiction. It does not require, it's at least not one of those minority jurisdictions that require bad faith, otherwise we'd really have a lot of trouble here. Okay, so, but here's our problem. Continuous for the statutory period. What is the statute of limitations in the state of Washington?
10 years.
Have they lived there and fulfilled all of these elements for the past 10 years?
The one that moved in for a year has it all.
Right. Okay. So that's the only people who are left now in this case. So the Pintos, right? They just moved in a year ago. Should they be able to claim ownership of this land by adverse possession if they have not been fulfilling all of those things for the past 10 years?
Well, isn't it actually the owners that are...
Oh, do I have the names backwards?
Is it Pintos?
Well, Pintos bought from the Millers, right?
Yes, I have that mixed. But the Millers were there for a long period of time, too, and they thought they had title to the deed, which is, I think, what the court was at. And that Millers thought they had a good deed, and that should give them title to it.
Right, so we have a couple ideas going on here. One is just this idea of if somebody has gained their title by adverse possession and a new person comes in, is it a legitimate transfer of title, or does that new person now have to make show all of the requirements for adverse possession? Can you pass on your title that you have acquired by adverse possession? That's one question. The other question is, if you haven't been there for 10 years, can you add on the time you've been there to the previous people? We call that tacking. And tacking, we see it in adverse possession. It's something you might see in other law classes, too. It's any time where your claim and your time for the claim can be added on to somebody else's that you're kind of inheriting the claim from. All right, so let's take the first issue, Amanda. If you have established your ownership by adverse possession and you have title by adverse possession, can you pass that on? Absolutely. If you have established adverse possession, you are the owner, you have title to it, and your deed is now a good deed, right? And anybody you sell it to, they just are the landowner. They inherit all the things you had. You had full title. You got it. In this case, they seem to be a little bit more taken with, though, the second question of whether or not you can... whether or not Kunto can tack his possession onto the prior owners. Now, the previous rule here before this case was this idea of privity of estate. Anyone heard that phrase before?
one person, two people. You will hear it again and again. We will get to it later in this class, but here's your first introduction to kind of an annoying legal conundrum. All right, could you figure this out, Amanda? What do you think constitutes privity?
That they should be have access to what they're claiming, that they should be the people who own that or on the property at the time.
Well, privity is a phrase that really refers to a relationship between parties. And we will see privity of contract. Have you? Well, you guys are in contracts now, right? So you haven't heard privity of contract yet, have you? Privity of contract is a phrase that just means kind of the people who are in a contractual relationship with each other. Privity of estate is about the relationships between people with regard to the property. So privity of estate is really about the relationship between the Millers and the Kuntos. And the Millers being the people that the Kuntos bought the land from, right? So what type of relationship were the Millers and the Kuntos in? And that defining that relationship helps us understand whether or not we think they should be able to tap, whether or not they should be able to add on. Shazi, you want to add something?
I was just going to say, they had within the case, they said it was the deeds running between the parties, connecting possession of successive occupancy.
And we'll see this later. This is actually what we would call vertical privity for when we get to that. But it's the relationship between the people who are transferring the land to each other. So when the Millers sell to the Kuntos, are they in a relationship that people think, that the court thinks is enough of a relationship that they should be allowed to tap? And here, the requirement had been the old common law approach had been that every successive occupation was a new trespass. And so you never got to tack. You never got to add them together. You always had to start afresh. Unless you can show that the current occupant had entered under current of title with a good faith belief. Color of title, remember, that means that they actually have a piece of paper in hand and they had a good faith belief. All right. So in this case, we do have that. We have kind of this, they have a paper in hand, they had a good faith belief that they were the landowners. So actually, even under the kind of the traditional description of privity and title, I think we have a good case here for the Kuntos. The court goes even further, however, to suggest that it thinks even though that rule is too narrow, that we should be looking at the relationship between the adverse possessors and not requiring necessarily this color of title thing. So if your intent is to continue the possession of the land, an adverse possessor should be able to continue kind of to add on. So if I'm an adverse possessor, but I suddenly am, I don't know, I'm going to go on sabbatical and leave for 6 months, and I say to my friend, can you please move into this house and watch it for me while I'm gone for 6 months? That will not usually disrupt we'll be able to tack our times together because we're kind of all meaning to adverse possess. If, however, I go away and somebody just moves in because they knew I left, like you guys heard me say I was leaving, and one of you just is like, I'm going to go move into our house, right? That is not going to, that's not kind of, we're not in a privity kind of relationship. We're not in enough of a relationship that a court is going to recognize that as us allowing to tack our time together. Does that make sense? It might help. Let's just do a couple quick examples because I think these make the most sense. Oh, wait. Those are my tolling examples. Where's my tacking examples? Tacking. We'll do tolling next. So tacking. All right. All right, Nathan. You occupy Tristan's land for 6 years. And then you tell your buddy Dom, you can stay if you want, but I'm taking off. Oh, and then Dom instead of Dom. Dom stays for 5 more years. Can we add those 6 and 5 years together?
Probably not. There's no privity or color or title being transferred. So Dominic.
Yeah, what do you think? Do you guys agree? Who should get this land? You agree with Nathan's assessment? Yeah. I think that's right. Right. This is the type of thing. It's not enough of kind of a transfer between the two. So I think this is probably not allowed. There's a connection between them. They're friends, but it's not enough of a connection to suggest that it's for the purpose of allocating property rights. The standard is like a reasonable connection from the Kunto case. The standard in Washington is a reasonable connection regarding the property. You guys have a relationship. Yeah, it's a reasonable connection regarding the property. So you guys have a reasonable connection, but it's not really about the property. All right, what about Jake and Jordan? Jake occupies Jordan's land for 2 years and then tries to convey the land to his pal Sam, but the deed he uses is invalid. Sam then stays for 9 years. These are 10 years. Okay. Jake, Sam, Jordan, who should get this property?
I think that I should.
You think you should?
More than because I'm selfish, but also I think that since it is for more than 10 years and we tried to do the deed, and even though it was invalid, I didn't realize it was invalid. I would testify I didn't know it was invalid.
See, that's what I tell you. You can't trust the adverse possessor. All right, but you only get to 10 years if you add together. So you have to make sure that you're allowed to add for 2 years to Jake. Jordan, what do you think? Are you going to contest?
Absolutely.
On what basis? We're just thinking about tacking. Do you think there's an adequate relationship here between in this conveyance of Jake and Sam?
What do you mean by convey?
Well, okay, that's a great one. So Jake tries to convey the land to his pal Sam, right? So this is what we have to try to figure out, whether or not we're going to allow tacking. Are we going to allow that 2 plus 9? Or are we going to say he's only been there 9 years instead of that? If we're going to allow him to count Jake's time that he was on the land, Jake has to have the conveyance, the transfer of occupancy between Jake and Sam has to meet enough of a reasonable connection regarding land. Sam thinks it's enough because there was a deed that he spoke to. I perhaps lied about that. Jake, what do you think?
I think it's just like the case that you just got the wrong plot of land on the deed and it's just correcting the deed.
Yeah, and I don't even think it matters whether or not Jake knows that the deed is legit. When we have a piece of paper that is conveying the land, that gives us color of title, even if we're not even going to inquire as to whether or not Jake just wrote that on the back of the cereal box, right? We're going to kind of give a little bit more weight to that. And we also see that it does suggest that just the transfer to the deed is a different attitude than these two guys saying, I'm heading out, you feel free to crash here if you want, right? That didn't seem to be really like an interest or a plan for anybody to like assert ownership. Whereas using a deed, even if it's a faulty one, has this kind of feeling to it, like they're meaning to do that.
Francis.
Isn't there no element of fraud on Jake's part there?
There might be an element of fraud, but frankly, we don't care that much. I mean, right? We'll see this in our property, in our personal property cases. There's actually some things that even if at the root of it, there's some kind of things that we might think of as wrongdoing, or we might call them, what's the phrase the courts like here? Land pirates. Even if Jake is a land pirate, we're going to kind of say that it doesn't matter because all of our principles for why we like adverse possession and kind of having access to the land, they're all going to kind of still weigh in favor of us giving the land to Sam.
When they say a relationship between the occupants and the land, as you describing their role for this,
it's not between the occupant and the land. It's a relationship between the first adverse possessor and the second adverse possessor.
And in regards to the land.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sorry, right.
If Nathan and Tristan had, let's say this is all true, but the first of the years between Dom and Tristan, they had spent together on the land. Would that then form like a bond between them over the land, or are we talking only in terms?
Well, and so we could change the facts of scenario one that would make it okay. So, if Nathan and Dom both live on the land, Dom doesn't have to rely on Nathan's claim. He could just be adverse possessor on his own because he would have been there for 11 years. So the matter that he transferred.
But let's say then Tristan leaves. So let's say they're on it together and then Tristan leaves and then. But he is only there for 9 years. What I'm trying to get is it through the deed or is it through their relationship in the land?
It is through their relationship in the land.
Okay.
right? But let's start with, let's think about this. We need to look at the state law. We see actually when the Washington court is describing just what the standard common law approach had been, there had to be color of title and good faith purchased. Right? Otherwise, you're successive trespassers. In that case, there's no way Nathan are knocking it, right? There's no kind of color of title, there's no good faith purchase. If we see that Sam is a good faith purchaser, like he thinks that's a real deed, he's totally fine under even like the stricter Washington standard. What Washington, what the court in the Howard v. Kunta case is saying we think that standard's actually a little bit too strict. And most states have kind of loosened that and said, you don't need this color of title good faith purchaser. You just need to kind of show some type of relationship between these two parties, between adverse possessor one and adverse possessor two, that meant for it to be kind of a continuous possession, that they meant to transfer their interest from one to two. The presence of a deed is good evidence of that. But it's not required. It's a really great piece of evidence that helps us show that they were really intending for this to be a continuous kind of land ownership, that they weren't kind of acknowledging that Jordan is the landowner. But unless we're in a state that is still kind of in that old model, it's stricter than we need. Okay, so that's tacking. The other thing your book mentions is something called tolling, which I guess I just put these slides backwards. Now, tolling. Tolling suggests that there's some times where there's something about the landowner, that the landowner is suffering from some type of disability, that we feel like it's not fair for us to start our adverse possession clock ticking against them, right? Because remember, we want to say that a reasonable landowner is out there kind of inspecting their land, and maybe there's some people we're kind of acknowledge that that's not reasonable for us to expect that of them, and we're going to give them a little extra time. Anybody pick up on what are the reasons we allow tolling? What are some of the disabilities that count? Please.
I think one was mental incapacity.
Mental incapacity.
Imprisonment,
yeah. Which one?
We also said military leave, too.
Military leave. In some states, not every state, actually, unfortunately. Because that seems extra harsh. Anything else? Nobody said the most common one yet. Charlie?
Minority age.
Right? We're not expecting the 5-year-old landowner to be out there monitoring her property. And you could see, actually, maybe we could, because we assume that they'll have a trustee or something. But there are, so these are the types of things. And this is usually outlined by statute. Those are the major ones. You might be in a state that has a couple other ones. I think usually being in a coma counts, things like that. So we can think of them in a reasonable kind of manner. Which types of things do we feel like it's unfair to start kind of the statute of limits, start the clock ticking against them? But also most states have a list that they went. So here's just kind of two classic examples, right? Allie's 10 years old in 2000, and Arthur begins adverse possession of her land that year. And we're in a place with 10-year statute of limitations. And the state allows suit 5 years after the removal of the disability. Okay, so when is the earliest point that Arthur can bring suit to try and get this land? What do you guys think?
2015.
You agree?
When does the
disability
come into
play? We have to do math here, right? Okay. In the year 2000, Allie was 10 years old, right? Okay, what's the disability here? Let's identify the disability. Age, right? She's too young. What is the age of majority?
18.
Okay. So, we're in a state. So, what year is she going to turn 18? 2008. I tried to make this easy math. Okay, and then state laws 5 years after the removal of her disability.
2013.
What? 2013, not 2015. Does that make sense?
So this is the most common approach, is that in the state statute, it'll tell you which way to do it. Some places, they don't start it at all. They wouldn't start the clock at all until she turned 18, right? So now you would have 2018 as being when the earliest time he could file suit. But most states, so you have to look at the state statute. So here we see, they're not going to make you, like, wait until she's 18 before you can start the clock. They're going to give you kind of a little bit of a leeway by giving you this 5 years. Okay. But now suppose Allie died in 2003. I'm sorry. That's supposed to be Arthur. Sorry. I'm just switching names around. Arthur, you still enter in 2000, and Allie has left everything to Ben. Ben, unfortunately, has been mentally incompetent since 2002. I don't know what happened that day. It was a rough day. He lost it. All right, now this is tricky. When do you think Arthur could claim the land now?
Never?
Never, because the disability would never be removed? Well, I think that logically makes a lot of sense. We would kind of feel some sympathy with Ben if that were true. But in most places, they do not allow tacking of disabilities. So what matters is what was the disability on the date that he entered the land, and it was her being underage. That disability was removed when she died.
So it's still 2013?
Not 2013. She dies in 2003. And what does the statute tell us?
Five.
At 5 years, which would be? 2008. But if there was no disability involved here at all, what year would it be? 2010-year statute of limitations. Right? If you just entered the... There's no disabilities. He enters the... Arthur enters the land in 2000. There's a 10-year statute of limitations. When you can make the claim? 2010. Right? Okay. If the
statute is going to give you a shorter time period, if the statute actually, if you follow the math, the statute gets you to 2008... We don't let you get the shorter of the two times. You get the longer of the two times. So it goes to 2010. A disability kind of tolling example exception cannot shorten the statute of limitations. It can only lengthen it. So we can see that these are kind of annoying, kind of complicated math sometimes, these tolling and tacking statutes. But I'm sorry, not the tacking. The tacking actually is very straightforward. You add like the 2 plus the 9, the 5 plus the 6. The tolling can be complicated because you have to look at what the state lists as its acceptable disabilities, and then you've got to kind of sometimes look at how they do the math, which could be different. Obviously, if I ever asked you a question about this, I would just very clearly tell you what the tolling statute was, instead of be like, figure out the common law of all 50 states on what it might be. But in practice, if you guys come up against questions with this, just remember this varies a lot by state law, and you're going to have to look up the statute of the jurisdiction here.
So tolling is just extra limitations on adverse possession?
Tolling is a phrase that you will hear in statute of limitations and all different types of things, right? The tolling is a way we have, and we're going to see it actually in our personal property issues cases next week, right? Tolling is just an idea that we're going to calculate our statute of limitations differently. We're going to give it a little bit more time. This is how we toll an adverse possession. We're going to give people a little bit more time because of these disabilities when we think it's just unfair to start counting, start the clock ticking. We'll see it. You'll see it in other areas of law and other classes all the time. Just different reasons where, for policy reasons, we think we should make that statute of limitations longer than it really was. You might see it in criminal law. You might see it, definitely see it in tort cases if you kind of went into more kind of advanced tort classes. There's different reasons why we let people get a little bit more time. Yeah? Allie?
I have a question.
Figured that's what the hand meant.
Would Arthur be able to adversely possess the land if Ben, even though he was mentally incompetent, was living on the land?
Well, he still has... This is... I'm just... we're just getting at the element of the statutory period, right? You would still, for any of these examples, and the tacking examples I gave you as well, you still have to meet all of the elements of adverse possession. So if Ben's living on the land and he can't show exclusivity, no, right? He won't be able to get it. But this, I'm trying to get at us just to dig at one question, just the statute of limitations. And remember, that's why the question is, what is the earliest point Arthur could get the land? That's when he could first initially make a claim. He still's got to meet all the other requirements. Okay, we're going to move on to owning real property, which means, like, by the time we got to break, I finally got to pay this reading. All right, we'll take a break in a minute. I just want to kind of say we're going to now move past land and think about this in terms of chattels. Was that a fun word to learn? Do people know the word? I like to just use that periodically when I'm talking about my stuff. I say my chattels. Chattels, right? Anything movable, movable property, personal property. And we see a lot of the justifications and ideas we saw in the very first class about why do we have private property rules, how do property rights work. They operate in the same fashion with personal property, but because of the real inherent difference of something that you can kind of move around and hide easily and that kind of falls apart quicker, we have pretty different rules regarding personal property than we do regarding land. So let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and we'll start there. All right, we're moving on to, so we did owning, we did owning real property, and now we're doing owning personal property. Okay, so let's start with, we're going to start with talking about State v. Shaw, and we can see how we're going to see some of our same ideas and rules that we came up earlier in this class are going to be quickly jumping back in. All right, let me see, who did I have? Oh, Charlie, can you do State versus Shaw for us? Yes. Page 162 or 160, depending on which book you have.
I read the airplane.
Oh my gosh, no. So how many of you guys did that? Only two of them. Right? Everybody realized we were skipping over, other people realized we were skipping over the airplane water cases. They're lovely, fun cases. There's a couple more things. There's a couple, right? There's like 20 pages or something. I said, let's skip over. They're very interesting cases, but just for sake of time, we're skipping over this. All right, look at this. All right, Lauren, you get your chance.
Okay. All right. With a fisherman in Lake Erie, and he had like two huge nets cast in the middle of the lake. And while he left, the defendant came and took fish from inside of the plaintiff's net. So the plaintiff was suing him because he thought he already had those fish, and the defendant argued that since it was like the state's property, like, he didn't really claim them yet, so it's, like, free game.
Yeah. So, was this a nice thing to do? With these nuts, are like, those are harder to see. But here's the idea, right? So first of all, let's know that this case is State v. Shaw. What does that tell us? Criminal case, right? So it's not just a kind of a conversion tort case, right? That these guys have actually been charged with grand larceny, right? theft of movable property, right? So, and so here's like some really kind of hard to see diagrams of the fishnets. And the fishnets were owned by who?
The fishnets were the plaintiffs. It was the state. So, Shaw.
No?
I mean the, who was the other guy?
Crow and Hugh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, the other guy.
Okay, right, so we have these two fishermen. So they set up these big fishnets. And the fishnets have a lot of fish in them?
A ton, like 300 pounds or something.
A ton of fish in them.
Yeah.
The fish swim in, they get caught. There is an ability for a few extra smart fish to make it back out if they can, like, retrace and get to it. But the vast majority of the fish are trapped in these nets once they swim in. All right, Lauren. Thinking about Pearson v. Post, how the fox case, right? If we think about our fox case, how, if and we follow the rule of the fox case, what should the outcome be here?
that once it's in your property, or that was when he was chasing the fox all day, and then the defendant shot at the last minute.
That's the one. And okay. Who got the fox, right? We have the guy who's chasing the fox all day. He's got his hounds. He's got his horses, chasing him all day. But at the end, at the last minute, somebody else grabs the fox. Who wins?
It was the plaintiff in that case, right?
So which one is that? The hunter or the ne'er-do-well?
The hunter.
No.
No, it was the opposite. And the hunters would have agreed that... That's
right.
Wrong.
Okay, so if we remember, so Pearson v. Post is the case that first articulates the rule of capture. And here we're trying to think about whether or not the rule of capture should apply here. In the rule of capture, it was not the person who invested all the time and energy in hunting that fox. It was the person who actually captured the fox and got that fox under his control and was able to walk off with it at the end of the day. So, following the logic of that case, who should have these fish?
Shaw.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, so following that, right, because... He's the one who actually got the fish in his hands and walked off with them. Somehow the court does not follow Pearson v. Post that strictly, and they do not find for Shaw. Why not?
Well, they talked about how it was like kind of already in his possession, even if, like they said, there was...
Who's his here? We got to be...
Oh, sorry. I know. It's the state for Shaw. It's the Groh and Ho.
That's I've never
heard of
that. I don't know. I don't know the guys, right? I've always said Hugh, but I think Groh and Ho sounds awesome. All right. All right. So whose possession? So tell us again.
So the court rules in his for Groh
and his buddy.
And his buddy, G&H. And they said like normally. The defendant was arguing since there's a slight possibility that the fish could come out, like if that means like it's not in his full control yet. But the court talked about like how even though it may be possible in practically it's impossible. So they said like it was already in his possession. Or like he had not controlled.
Yes. So what we see here is the court kind of differentiating a little from the really stringent rule of Pearson v. Post, where you had to actually be physically holding the fox, to say they were basically controlling them by having them in these nets. The chances of escape were so small. They were all gathered there. They were clearly, even evidence of how easy it was for this guy to just bring up the nets and get the fish shows you that they had kind of confined and controlled them. And so in that way, putting them in these nets was very similar to like putting an animal in a cage, that you had kind of, you were exerting enough control over it. So the fact that there was kind of this small chance that they could escape didn't matter. So here we see the rule of capture being applied. That's like the logic they're using. They're just not kind of as stringent about actually needing to hold on to the fox as they're saying. You know, they had total control, really, over these animals. And that therefore, they should be then practically impossible for them to escape. They were confined. The Ohio Supreme Court reasoned that the rule of capture does not require absolute security against possibility of escape. It just has to say that you kind of have enough exerted control over it. There's like some, just because you could think of some scenario where they might get out, that's not going to be enough. Now, if we think about the fact that this is a criminal case, should we handle it any differently? Who do you guys feel sympathetic with here? The fish, G&H? Right? Nobody feels sympathetic with the Shaw coming by and getting this fish and now being in prison for grand larceny? Yeah.
I think the burden of proof should be on the state and it should be higher, so I think they should have stuck to a more closer reading to the Pearson v. Post precedent instead of like extending it
yeah.
Cover a new ground.
So I think there's a good argument for that here. Right? We don't see that, but you know, most of our cases where we're, you know, the Pearson v. Post is a civil case, right? It's preponderance of the evidence, like who gets the fox. We know that it's a state criminal case, and of course, we know without them having to say that the burden of proof is on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. But at the same time, that doesn't tell us about how they what they're trying to prove. They're trying to prove beyond a reasonable doubt how much control he had. Have you guys come across the rule of lenity? Has that been mentioned in your criminal law? Okay. Not yet? Yes and no, perhaps, depending on which professor you have. Okay. The rule of lenity is this kind of a rule of thumb that we use when it kind of these construction, statutory construction type ideas for when we're trying to interpret laws. And we think that there is something so different about depriving somebody of their liberty that we are going to construe those laws in favor of the person being accused of the crime. Does that make sense? If you have a law that's kind of vague, you read a law and you're like, I'm not sure if he broke that or not because the phrasing of it seems a little vague to me. You're always supposed to err on the side of the defendant. We're supposed to kind of give them more of the benefit of doubt that the rules weren't clear. Anytime we have kind of an interpretation question. So some people might argue that the rule here, of the rule of capture, what the standard was, wasn't that clear. And so therefore we should have erred a little bit on the side of Shaw. Instead of kind of, you know, it's different than if we were just fighting him for the price of the fish. We're actually going to deprive him of his liberty for this. Yeah.
They don't say that in the case, because it is a very, very short opinion, and maybe it's just an excerpt, but I think they're taking public policy into account, too. Because in the beginning of the 20th century, Lake Erie is a huge fishing industry, and therefore you'd see like these things all over the coastline, and if you could just go and fish on them.
Right, absolutely. If we think about all of our justifications for property, we could see that perhaps the policy reasons are pretty good in favor of protecting the fishermen. The same way we actually could have made that same argument in Pearson Post, right? If we want to have a good fishing industry, we are going to allow people to kind of invest in fishing and have secure property rights. And we don't want people, other public policy ideas, we don't want people kind of engaging in a fist fights over fish. That's my new Dr. Seuss book. Those are the public policy reasons. What about, Lauren, what about some of our other property justifications? Do any of our other property theories come into play here? What about first in time?
It would definitely be G and H.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Well, yeah. They were in his nets first.
They were in his nets first, yeah. So, but we could see how that could go either way. But they were in the other guy's hands first. But
sure.
Right. But all right. What about labor?
I think both. He took it from inside of H or G.
He's just pulling these
from the guy's net.
He's just like going out there and pulling the nets up.
Oh, and I think G and H.
G and H, right?
Definitely
right? Because they are the ones who actually kind of invested the time and energy in kind of in creating all of this. All right. all right, so anyway, so we see how our property theory, personhood?
Probably not.
I'm not too persuasive the personhood in fish that we're selling at market. I don't think anybody's kind of developed a big attachment to the, Jamie has an attachment to the fish.
Because fishermen, like, that's their job, that's their livelihood, and I feel like if they probably have an attachment to their occupation and to the stuff that they capture.
So there is, like, if you are interested in this, there are kind of just, like, fascinating property rights wars over fishing and lobsters, in particular in Maine. And, like, and people come to blows about kind of who is in whose zone, who's using who. If you touched another man's lobster pot, God forbid. Or
have you seen Deadly's Cast?
No. Really, like, if it's, have you seen any TV show, the answer is no. I haven't, but I have read some very nerdy property books about the lobster wars, or oysters. Oysters also, oysters don't move as much, so even more so that there's kind of these big kind of property battles that erupt because of these things. All right, so there's something particular though about these animals that of these rules we make for rules of capture regarding them. So both the fox and the fish, we characterize as ferrare naturae, right? These wild animals. Would anyone find the Latin phrase that, for the non-wild animals? I'm just trying to get somebody else to pronounce it. Yeah. That's about as well as I say it, too. Anime revertendi or something like that. which is like the animals who are have a tendency to return to you. So we have kind of created, and one of the things that they kind of talk about in the casebook here is that we have these different rules that we've kind of created about this rule of capture. We talked about this a little bit with Pearson V. Post, that there's animals that we feel like you have exerted control over in a different way. That there's something, right? A wild rabbit maybe isn't yours until it's actually been snared, but a cow wandering off is a cow's you've actually kind of. There aren't wild cows here. There are some countries, but there's no wild cows roaming free here. So for the most part, they are animals that we have exerted control over, and it's just kind of happenstance that one has wandered off. These are always fun. All right, Zach, you have a pet fox. That's very cute. It escapes, and Allison finds that she wants to keep it for her own. Can you get it back?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
I think you have a pretty solid property interest in the fox since it's a pet and not a wild animal.
So you think you could get it back?
Yeah, I think the distinction is made between a pet and a wild animal.
All right. What do you think? Allison?
Should I have 20 years? Should I say what I think?
What do you think?
I think
you don't have to fight for the fox if you don't really want it.
I think if it really is a domesticated fox, there is such a thing.
There's enough of one that I could find a picture on the internet. Yeah, well, so this is interesting because I think if we look at it on a case-by-case basis, which some courts do, we would say, does this look like an animal that's a pet? Does it look like an animal that, invests in time? But most courts do not. Most courts just classify it based on the type of animal. So it does not matter if you have a lovely, a pet crocodile. What matters is whether or not crocodile is like the type of animal that we think of as a domesticated animal. So you would probably lose your fox, because if it's a wild animal and it has gotten out, the next person to capture it then becomes the owner of it. Unless you can show that it falls into this other case. Oh my god, everybody hates this. So many hands. Alright, so with that.
I just have like a fact that they use foxes for domesticity to see like how many generations.
They use it for what?
To do studies on like domesticating animals. They use foxes, and like they find that within two generations
that you could tame a fox.
Yes, and so they have like the mean foxes. Like they take like abnormally mean foxes and they breed them, and then you get like this super mean breed of foxes. And then you take like the docile ones and within and breed them, and then in two generations you have like these healthy foxes.
Well, I think there's a lot of animals that are like. I kind of think are hard to classify. Rats, right? I think generally we think of rats. I think a lot of places will say that, rats are wild animals, but we know actually there's a lot of weird people out there, I don't know, perhaps in this room, that have rats as pets, right? And so if we're just classifying it based on the animal and not based on the actual circumstances, it feels unfair. But if we think about it, the fact that like, well, how was I supposed to know you had a pet rat? There's just rats everywhere. Like I killed your rat because it just looked like the other. So the policy reason behind it isn't, it's supposed to be that we could look at an animal type and know whether that animal type is a wild animal or a tamed animal, and we don't have to actually sit there and be like, does it have a collar? Does it answer when I call? We're just going to classify the animal.
This example is the most kind of the far known one.
Yeah. You want to do it?
Well, I don't know. My question: is it about whether the animal is safe or whether it's home? Because like a rhino, there's no way it's an Amherst if somebody doesn't have a property interest.
But yeah, I'm just here about ownership here, right? It's just like, can you assert an ownership right based on our theories about wild animals and the rule of capture? And remember, so if it's a wild animal, the rule of capture tells us that you can grab it and you can make it yours. Now, there might be other reasons why we don't want people owning rhinoceroses, and there might be other statutes that govern that. But if we're just basing it on kind of the rule of capture ownership, if you have a fox and foxes are classified as a wild animal and it gets out, the next person who finds that fox can take it.
What about
like animals, I mean, you.
I'm not going through every animal.
I know, but like animals, like rats, okay, but what about like rabbits? Like a lot of people have rabbits, but a lot of people hunt rabbits.
Yeah, I don't actually, we have to, a fun project is to figure out the case law and figure out whether those are automatically classified as wild animals or not. I think they are. And it's this idea, like, if I'm out there and, like, there's a bunch of rabbits in my yard, how am I really supposed to be able to tell that one's somebody's pet versus the other ones? I mean, I don't know. Maybe you can argue that it's white, there's not a lot of white rabbits in the wild, but it's usually classified by the animal, not kind of by the individual that you're looking at. Yeah,
what if you have, like, newborn animals?
No, right? Not if it's a wild animal. Like, all... This is just the common law, right? And I hope we realize that, you know, we learn a lot of common law, and we realize that that states and localities can change the common law by statute. So we could have a statute in here that says in New York and or you know in Amherst or something that says you know if you have a wild animal but you have kind of tamed it and domesticated it and you can show the paperwork that you got its shots or something you can get it back. But for the most part, we're just thinking about the background policy. So we're trying to kind of make a kind of clear rules that most people can figure out from looking at an animal what they're supposed to do. All right, let's do the rhinoceros, Courtney.
The rhino's
fine. The rhino's yours. Everybody agree she gets to keep the rhino, take it home? Barring any kind of rules about whether or not you're zoned for rhinoceros. Rhinoceri? Charlie.
Well, if you took reasonable protections and precautions to prevent escape from the air, and you previously had to maintain an enclosure subjecting it to your own will, why would you maintain ownership of the rhino if you took it upon itself to escape?
I love that the rhino took it upon itself to escape. I just like that phrase. Well, okay, so one thing I will say. I will say that sometimes if an animal can show enough indicia of ownership, like when you actually see it, like it's wearing an outfit or a sign that says owned by the zoo or something, some courts have found that that is enough that you can get the animal back. But now, maybe a rhinoceros does not need that, right? A rhinoceros is not wild to this area. And therefore, we know that a rhinoceros, like running down the street, is not just a purely wild animal. So that matters, right? It matters. So unless we live in a rhinoceros-populated area, the prior possessor is going to get this animal back. We don't think of it as a wild animal, so you don't have the same kind of rule of captive. I'm sorry, Courtney. I know you're bummed. Yes.
Is this kind of related to? Even like when you end up like hunting and shooting like a tagged animal, like if you shoot a deer that's been tagged, usually you have to like report it to someone. Is that like in any way related? Because obviously it's not like they own the animal; it's still wild.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think, I mean, that's just a detail I don't know. So these are kind of like the background common law rules. If the state wants to make a statute that says, like, tagged animals have to, you know, you've got to report it to the DNR or something like that, they could do so. If you're really interested in animals, we have both an animal law class at the school and in natural resources, I teach the rules about wildlife. And there you definitely get into kind of some of these rules about kind of that we see in hunting of developing of what they can say to him. All right. Last thing I want to say about this is I just want to introduce kind of the idea of the rule of custom. The rule of custom was presented in Pearson v. Post as right in the dissent, who said maybe we should be submitting this to a tribunal of hunters who are going to like tell us what the right thing is. You can see that in some ways it feels like they're doing that in State v. Shaw, even though they don't actually explicitly do that. But they are kind of thinking like, what is the custom here? The custom is that people have, you know, these fishing nets out there and they go and pull them up periodically. We would really be disrupting the custom of fishing if we were to do so. And it's notable that they kind of cite the they reference a case about whaling. Whaling has very kind of almost hard to understand customs about who gets it. It's like whoever like lands the first harpoon gets it, even if that doesn't actually kill the animal, right? So like within whaling, because whales are so hard to capture, they've kind of developed their own kind of rule of custom within it. So it's, I think it's, we see this court much more amenable to thinking about custom than we saw in the Pearson v. Post court that kind of poo-pooed the idea. Let me see if I have this aside. Yeah, Tragedy of the Commons. All right. The Tragedy of the Commons, people have come across this before. All of my econ majors, I hope, perhaps. Some? All right, so the Tragedy of Commons. So the rule of capture does not work that well when our resources are scarce. If we're talking about fishing in Lake Erie, and the rule of capture just says whoever can get out there and grab the fish first can have them, including like taking them out of people's nets, what's the motivation for fisher folk? Money, but you're, and what you would do every day is you would go out and catch as many fish as you could. Now, if you owned all of Lake Erie, however, your actions might change, right? Because if you're the only one who can, if you're the one who's controlling and making the decisions about the fishing, you might not fish as much as you can each day. You might instead kind of figure out how many fish are can you take without depleting the resources. Does that make sense? So the classic example of this used to be in English towns and also kind of in early American towns. There would be a town square, like a field of grass in the middle of the town, and people were allowed to come and graze their animals on that. Now the motivation would be, it always makes sense for you to bring all of your animals that you can to graze on that land instead of having them at home grazing on your land. This is free food, free grass. Rather get them get as much free food as they can than sitting at home and eating up your grass that is, you had to pay for. It's not limitless. The problem is, because every person's motivation is to put as many animals as they can on that land to take advantage of the free grass, we deplete the resource. You know, a week later, there's no grass on that land. We've destroyed it. What is a way that we could change that? What could we do to prevent everybody running out and everybody putting their cows, everybody going out and capturing the fish?
Yeah. Could you regulate how often people were on there with their animals? Maybe every week a different owner?
Absolutely. So the first thing we could do is make community rules. And sometimes these are done just within the community themselves, kind of like informal norms. Like you go around to all your neighbors and you kind of just say, hey, let you take Tuesdays. Or and sometimes we don't trust the neighbors to do that, so we have the government, the local town makes a rule about who can go on which days. And that way you can have oversee the resource and protect it. Any other way you might do it? Yeah, great.
Wouldn't simply just property rights, parceling out the land?
So property rights, this is why Tragedy of Commons is talked so much, mentioned so often in property or natural resources, because it is, property rights are looked at as a potential solution to Tragedy of the Commons. If you own that land yourself, you would make different decisions. So maybe what we need to do is, chop up the land and give everybody a quarter of an acre or whatever it is. And that way we would make different decisions. So this is kind of one of the things, the hardest place to do this though is in fisheries, because if you kind of just divide up part of the lake, it's really hard to tell the fish. They have to stay in that part of the lake. And so we have a lot. So we see that some of the rules we make about property rights in some wild animals in particular, but also in other natural resources, are really, we have to look out for the Tragedy of the Commons. So if we want to add to our policy reasons of why we might see property rules ending up the way they are, for certain categories of property, we can see that the Tragedy of the Commons might be part, and trying to avoid it might be part of what's motivating some of the judges. I think that is I think that's motivating the judge here in St. Pete Shaw, right? Like, let's actually think about what rules we might adopt that are going to not just lead to everybody kind of going out and grabbing as much fish as they can all the time. I'm not sure it's like the most successful way to save the fisheries of Lake Erie, but that is kind of one of the motivations you can see going on there. Okay. Everyone's favorite. All right. Anna. Sorry, there's a lot of Elsa and Anna in my home these days. All right. You're a baseball fan? Do you remember this game?
No,
because you were two, right? All right. Jake, you know this? Yeah, all right. Okay. This is like, I remember this well. All right. This happened while I was in law school. All right, Popov versus Hayashi. All right. What's the basic facts here?
Okay, so Barry Bonds is the record for home runs.
ball goes into his hands, the sky, pop off, goes to catch it. Says he has possession, but there's this whole like ball, everybody else is trying to get the ball. The ball rolls away. Ayashi comes over, picks it up, puts it in his pocket.
Alright, anybody here ever catch a foul ball? Did you catch it firmly in your glove?
No.
No. No, nobody did?
Bare hand.
I caught it in my beer mug. So the only foul balls I've ever gotten have been me scrambling on the ground to pick it up, right? If you had caught it and then dropped it, was it yours, or is the person who picks it up next? For those of you who picked them up off the ground, did anybody get there before you and you snagged it away from them? Nobody wants to admit punching the guy in the face.
I got one.
Stepping on the little kid.
I got one in a Toronto Blue Jays Yankees game.
Yeah.
And it like hit the guy's hand right behind me, and I heard it like smack, and then it like fell right in front of me, and I picked it up.
And you didn't turn around and give it to him? You let him hold it?
My dad let him hold it for like a second.
Was that a foul ball or a home run ball?
It was a foul ball. My dad was like, the odds of getting a foul ball at a, or, you know, when it, I don't know. It was a big thing for my dad.
All right. My dad used to catch them like every week. He had like seats that were just in the right spot. So I guess it's not that rare for some people. But anyways, let me see if I have this. It's like not working. Wait just a second. So nobody remembers seeing this? There's a movie about it. I'll like slowly put this up while we're talking about it. There's a movie about this called Up for Grabs, a very clever name.
They're all on top of each other. They're all, well, first of all,
right? In the just I don't know if all stadiums do this, but a giant stadium, there's like a, just this area where they just let everybody stand and try and catch home run balls, and it's just, you saw it, just packed. It's just packed with people all waiting for this ball to be hit. It's like being in a mosh pit. And then we hear them jumping on him. You see them jumping on him. You hear them screaming at him. All right. So, Anna, who should own this baseball?
Well, the court ends up giving it to both of them, but I think it probably just got to be very positive and will be.
Oh, really?
Point. Yeah.
And why is that? Why are they owners of this baseball?
Well, there was a whole thing with, the baseball was just dislodged by incidental contact with an inanimate object or another person before a mind of the deceased is not possessed. So, Popoff didn't have control of the ball entirely. And then,
But why does that... So, Popoff not having control of the ball, I'm still not sure why you're saying you think it should go to Barry Bonds or the MLB.
Like with Derek Jeter, when he got his hits, they always made sure the ball went to him so he could keep it as a personal metric for himself. And I would think something like that would go into like a Baseball Hall of Fame so that everybody can appreciate it.
All right, but all of you guys who have caught foul balls or scrambled to take them off of the ground, did any of you guys think this should go back to the Major League Baseball? No. Would it have been a home run? Would you feel differently about that? If it had been a home run, do you feel like it was is owned by them? Ben?
It says that, I don't know if the court just decides or if it's precedent, but it says that once the player hits the ball, it becomes abandoned property.
That is the custom of baseball. It is not the custom in all sports, right? If you are watching a basketball game and the basketball goes in the stand, it is not the custom that you get to keep the basketball. It is not considered to be an abandoned, right? Baseballs, they are considered to be abandoned. Now, and it's a change in custom. It didn't used to be true because it used to be that like, they were kind of expensive and MLB wasn't as... god-awful rich as it is today. And so they couldn't afford to kind of lose baseballs. And you were supposed to actually hand the baseballs back so they could continue to use them in the game. Times have changed, and that is now kind of, whether it's custom or actually it might even be explicitly stated sometimes on your ticket, like baseballs are considered to be abandoned objects. I think it's partially you could do that so you don't sue them when they hit you. So there is like, so that part, the court does not even really get into that, whether or not MLB should own it because they didn't abandon it or Barry Bonds didn't abandon it. But that is the argument for, that's like why that's kind of, we clear that out. There's no, they have abandoned the property, they are not asserting ownership claims. Notice they do not appear in this case. Neither party, neither the main MLB nor Barry Bonds is showing up to argue for the baseball.
This is kind of awesome, but if you just had like a drone and it caught the ball before it landed, could they be mad at you if it's a better property?
Yes. Wait. Can they be mad at you? They can.
Can they sue you because it's a better property?
Because it's all right. You're definitely kind of first of all getting kicked out of the baseball stadium. Right? Don't we know, right? You're not supposed to interfere with the ball while in play? What's wrong with you? I don't know. I guess it's true that if I don't know, we think of court of balls when they're hit into the stands as being abandoned property. I don't know if we think of that the moment they hit the air. Does the court say that, the moment they hit the air?
Well, the moment the bat hit the ball.
Yeah, I would argue with that. I think it's the moment that it leaves the outfield, but that's not really an issue because they didn't come forward to assert ownership, so we don't actually have a debate over whether or not the ball was abandoned or at what point it was abandoned and what point the MLB lost ownership. But obviously, right, if it lands in the outfield, we don't think of them as having abandoned it. But so that we'll get to abandonment, so it's kind of helpful. But all right, so now we're talking about, we're putting aside Barry Bonds and MLB, and we've got to figure out Popoff, the guy, and you see this, right? You can kind of see it in that video, as bad as it is. You see it land in his glove. And then you see him get tackled to the ground, and then we see Hayashi holding it up. All right, who should own it amongst these two if we're thinking about the rule of capture? If a baseball is like a wild animal.
I would say Hayashi because he had control of the ball.
Right. So that's if we think of who had ultimate control over the ball, Hayashi is the one who actually brought it into his control. And yet the court does not simply award Hayashi ownership, even though the court is absolutely influenced by the rule of capture. Why not?
Popov had, he was attacked, which prevented him from getting full control of the
wall. Yeah, it's because Rom, so he had the potential to, we don't actually know. We don't actually know whether if there was nobody around him, if he would have been able to hold on to that ball or not. Right? We don't know how good this guy is at catching or how really well it was in his glove. So we don't know whether or not he would have been able to hold on to it. They say that the evidence kind of differs on that. So then we have to say, but for sure, he can't hold on to it because wrongdoers, and they say Hayashi wasn't one of them. Hayashi was not one of the guys who jumped on him, not one of the guys who's yelling at him, none of that. He's just in the background and picks it up when it rolls out. They say wrongdoers are the ones who interfered. So we feel that he could have, by the rule of capture, gotten this baseball, but for the fact that wrongdoers interfered with his right. Now, to make this holding, the court creates a new idea of called what they call a prepossessory right. This idea that he actually, before he had full possession, right? This is a twist on the rule of capture. You don't have, even before you have full possession, even before you actually have those fish in your net or you have that box in your hands, you have some type of right that is gives you kind of clear, it's like you have dibs. I've got dibs, you can't get in my way. If you get in my way, I have lost. You've taken something away from me and it's not fair. Anyone think of any other place we acknowledge a prepossessory right? I'm always trying to think of good examples for this. It's a really unusual idea. I mean, you can kind of, right, we could kind of try and stake claim to something and say it's ours, but there's very few places. I don't have like an example in the back of my pocket. I'd be really excited if somebody came up with that. Like, there's very few places where like, oh, I've like declared that will be mine, so I get it. That Nate.
What if there was like the last item in a grocery store, and you have
it in
the cart, but you
have to pay for it? Ooh, yeah. Can somebody reach out of your cart and grab it? That's an awesome one. Black Friday. We're like.
All bets are off. I don't think there's.
Right, so can people grab it out of your hands? Can they grab it out of your cart? Like, at what point, that's a good example. At what point do you have a possessory right to it? Like, if you put it in your cart, you feel like, well, I've exerted some control over it. But obviously, there's a wrongdoer who could come and take it out of your cart. Now, the better example to make it like this case would be a wrongdoer takes it out of your cart, looks at it, decides it's the wrong size, drops it on the floor, and the next person picks it up. Does that next person who kind of wasn't the wrongdoer, do they get the item, or do you get the item because you only lost it because of a wrongdoer interfering with your prepossessory right to get this whatever special Black Friday item? We can see that there's definitely things that are social norms, right? There's social norms we can say about like who gets things first or standing in line, stuff like that, but none of those are law. This is an example where they're elevating what might feel like a social norm in some ways of kind of this prepossessory right into law. This is really an unusual case. And it's an unusual case, first, I think from a sporting standpoint, I think a lot of people felt like it just would go to Hayashi. That's just kind of the norms in baseball, right? Is if it's whoever ends up with the ball at the end, as long as he didn't like punch Popov in the face to get it, right? Like that, this happens. A lot of times people don't really capture them. If we were going to, as in Pearson v. Post, consult our panel of sportsmen, I think we would come up to with the answer that Hayashi, right? How many of you, panel of sports enthusiasts here? Hayashi? Papa? Three of you for Papa. Charlotte, why Papa?
Well, it seems that the gentleman at the game, he's in the right spot, he's got a glove, he's probably a regular attendee, probably has some level of skill. He sticks his hand in the air, and the ball goes directly into the glove. So
yeah.
That zone is pretty stunning at the stance to begin with. And so, I'm sure I couldn't throw up a lot of catch the ball. I mean,
he's probably like 2 feet taller than you. I mean, like, this is like, in some ways, this guy catches it by luck. He's just like, all of them are standing there. They all have gloves. Hayashi has a glove, too.
Yeah.
So we're rewarding luck, but that's what we do in baseball, right?
I suspect he had probably a fairly decent chance of bringing that down and maintaining possession of the ball, if there hadn't been a mob attacking him, jumping down on him to try to dislodge the ball and take
it. Yeah. Mary?
I just want to say that I found this case kind of disappointing, because I feel like it was like a cop-out by the court. They like...
Absolutely. Everybody...
Like, he has a really good reason, and he has a really good reason, so yeah, we're just going to not make a decision.
Well, so that's what I said. This is the other thing that's annoying about this case, or surprising about this case. So in property rules are very different than what we normally see kind of in contract or other realms. So property is actually known for this idea that it tends to be an all or nothing approach. It tends to be either you are right or you're wrong. We do not actually usually take this Solomon-like approach of splitting the baby, right? And I think all of the parties were involved in this idea that they were going to just declare that they had to split the money, to split the proceeds from the baseball, because generally in property, you figure out who is the owner and that person's the owner. Equitable division is a very rarely used thing. It is mostly used in divorce proceedings, right? It's like almost the only, like, the, that's the little... It's like really the only place I ever see it. In divorce proceedings, when you have like, jointly owned property and you're trying to split it up, the equitable division. So they're taking kind of a doctrine that's used mostly in divorce proceedings when we have real emotional struggles trying to figure out who should own things. And they're applying it to this baseball, and a lot of people agree that perhaps the judge was just trying to figure it out. This is, I was in law school at the time, and my, one of my law professors was worked on this case, and the ones cited are like Hastings Law. It's like all of the San Francisco Bay Area, like Stanford, Hastings, and Berkeley law professors are all like, it's just like it's like a perfect exam question, right? In some ways, so it's like they all got really excited about it and came in on every side. I wish I was Professor Brian Ray and be like, yes, the Gray Rule named after me, which can apply in like zero circumstances other than. When people fight over baseball. Now, I know you guys have a couple of questions, but I want to also point out that if we think about the different theories of property here, if we think about first possession, we see we're trying to reward first possession here, and we're almost kind of looking for a reason to reward first possession. We also see the labor theory kind of weighs in favor of Papa as the one who kind of was out there and working and got it. But and I think it's thin because they both kind of were out there to catch the baseball. The labor theory, we should give it to Barry Bonds, right? But public and personhood, too, goes to Barry Bonds, right? Personhood doesn't help either of these guys too much. I think they're both pretty excited to capture this baseball, although they both want to just sell it. So that's not really... We might feel differently if they were like, no, I'm like, I love Barry Bonds. I've been to all of his games. I want this baseball for my own to keep and to think about. We might have seen a different resolution. The court might have felt much more pressed to not do equitable division. But public policy. What public policies are we endorsing if we go with one versus the other? Yeah, Kayla.
I was thinking that maybe public policy wise is trying to discourage people from like clobbering over a baseball.
Absolutely. Right? That is what they're trying to do. If we are just going to give it to Hayashi, if we're just going to give it to the last man standing, that's going to lead to more fights at baseball stadiums. And or maybe in other similar situations where we feel like a fight over not to focus on
the if they were trying to promote that policy and it didn't work at all, because like 2 years later he broke the career home run record and the dude who came away with the ball was like bloody and bruised, like crying and like held the baseball up. So
crying with joy.
Their public policy goal was not achieved.
Right. Yeah. And not only that, we actually saw like what happens from a public policy standpoint was actually probably misguided in that they also led to more people trying to sue for the part of the baseball. So then we had subsequent cases, I think it's a Mark McGuire case, where people like try to, now everybody who's involved in the brawl who touches the ball at one point tries to argue that they had at least some pre-possessory interest. So it actually had maybe a public policy implication that this court did not foresee that was increased litigation over baseballs. So subsequent courts have kind of not adopted this, right, this stance of kind of like, dividing the baseball for all of the reasons you guys
mentioned. Yeah. So I guess I just don't even see how it would discourage people from fighting because, I mean, you're still rewarded by getting, half of the potential, half of the baseball and you tackle somebody. You're still going to, like, punishment for like being the wrongdoer?
Well, the wrong. So there's a punishment for being the wrongdoer. The wrongdoer can't get it.
Oh, okay.
Right. So Hayashi was not a wrongdoer.
If you're not getting it anyway, then you're not really being punished because you're not losing it.
I know.
So there's still no...
It's also really... I don't think there's many people out there in the stands that are sitting there thinking, well, I happen to know that the California court is going to to really punish me for pushing this guy over. Like, I don't think that many people... Even if you knew that law, I don't think you think about it in the heat of the moment when you're just going after the baseball. So I'm not sure from a public policy standpoint this achieved any of the goals of this judge. But what it is interesting is to see, here we have a case from 2002 citing Pearson v. Post, right, this old case about chasing foxes and bringing in law professors. There's like, it is not a case that's statute and precedent and stuff. It's like very much a property theory case. And this is why textbooks have started to include it, because it's like kind of like, oh, it's like kind of an interesting discussion of what theories of property and ownership mean in a case about a baseball. That we see, you know, Pop-Up made so many mistakes here, including paying his attorney by the hour and spending more money than he got in the end for the baseball. I also think he's short-sighted to think that I like the language is like, who knows when another ball like this might happen. I'm like, oh my god, like all the time now, right? It's like back. First of all, Barry Bonds isn't like retiring today, so he's gonna hit more. But so I saw him. Hi.
I think it should have belonged to just Papa, especially kind of leaning on the ruling of O'Keefe v. Snyder, where the court held, you know, that the person did due diligence to recover whatever was lost, and whether it was good faith that Hayashi got the ball or that it just happened to that the ball was close to him. I think Papa still did what he could at the time was to recover the ball, and for that reason I think it should belong to him.
Oh, that's a good labor theory, too. Like, he kind of was working hard to protect his rights. You know, O'Keefe v. Schneider is so different because it's really like this adverse possession case, but maybe kind of some interesting kind of at least theories behind it. Matt?
Yeah. I was kind of like on the fence about this, but now I think about it more, I would be really disappointed if I was Pop-Pop. But I'm just looking at the court's actual rule again that they come up with, and they say that somebody who takes significant incomplete steps to achieve possession is interrupted by the unlawful acts of others has legally cognizable prepossessory interest. That to me seems like they're saying like he would have had possession of it if not for the unlawful acts of others. So doesn't that mean then, you know, he should get it?
You feel like he's copying off because you feel it's a cop up because some of his logic sounds like he wants to give it to Pop Up, right? Like, there's no reason actually, if you follow the logic of this opinion, that you get to the end and understand that splitting it makes sense.
Yeah.
I think the reason is that he could not prove that he actually would have been able to hold on to it.
Yeah, and if I get like that language too, but then like if they're gonna go and say that, like, well, we don't know if he would have had it, so then he didn't have it. You know,
right.
Anyone around that, you know, that crowd could have said that, oh, well, I would have had it on being blocked by someone else.
Yeah, right. It's like pass interference.
Yeah.
Right. It's like you could kind of study, I don't know, right? So it is weird because even by the logic of the case itself, it doesn't really feel like the right resolution to just say split it in half. It still feels like they're on a journey of asserting one to be the owner, one's ownership right to be more than the other. But it seems to me that they're saying, like, both of these guys have kind of not complete ownership rights, so we'll just divide it because we don't know what else to do. Yeah, Doug?
Even with, like you said, that the judge couldn't prove that the ball would have stayed in Pop-Pop's hand, but if you follow the Shaw precedent, should that matter? I mean, the judge there could not prove that the fish would have stayed in those nets, but that didn't matter.
So I think a really fun question to ask here is whether we think that the baseball is more like a fish in a net, or is it more like a fox running free, right? So then that, because then we can see that the rule of capture is is modified a little bit by that. All right, I really want to move on because you guys see I get behind schedule so easily. Okay, let's move on to categories of found chattels. All right, so we see in our cases, so this is like, you know, lost and found, finders, keepers. These cases are fun and short. And we see, but can sometimes still be confusing. And we see that there are four categories of things. There's lost, mislaid, abandoned, and treasure trove. And it can be very challenging to determine the distinction amongst these four. Right? And so treasure trove, I'm going to pretty much put aside. We don't really have any cases. I think there's like one squib case about treasure trove. Treasure trove really is the idea that you have found a lot of something, a large volume of something valuable that is really old. And the idea is that nobody who's still living and around today could have been the one who left it there. Right? Because it's so old. So there's no chance. Think of this, so there's no chance that somebody's going to come back and be looking for it. It does not matter if they have a treasure map or something like that. That's the idea. So, and that's a very kind of a small category of things and not a lot of case law. So we're really going to focus on the other three. And one of the weird things about this area of law is that we are trying to determine whether or not an item is lost, mislaid, or abandoned by looking at the item. That is really hard. That's like, you know, how can you tell by something, just an object itself, what the thinking was of the person who left the object there, right? So unless we have, like, I don't know, psychics who can touch the objects and tell what happened, we have this very hard factual scenarios here to deal with. So let's start with Armory versus the Laramie, my favorite kind of little, you know, masterpiece theater type of case here. Tristan, can you help us with this one?
Yeah, so the plaintiff was a chimney sweeper's assistant, like a kid, basically. Mm-hmm. And while he was cleaning, I guess, he found a ring, a jewel, and brought it to, like, a goldsmith to have it appraised, and the goldsmith ended up taking the jewel and trying to just pay the kid.
What was he going to pay him for?
I think just not the jewel itself, right?
Right. So this is whatever, this is not actually a picture of this ring because he knows what it looked like, but this is the idea, right? He brings a ring to him, and it's not actually the goldsmith. The goldsmith is actually a very famous guy. That is, you can go to the Victoria and Albert Museum and see big displays and a wing dedicated to him. There's like some, it's mostly silversmith, something he made over there. But so picture this. This goldsmith, this little like 10-year-old chimney sweep, little urchin. It's like Dickens, right? It's like, and he gives him this ring, and he takes out the jewels. He goes back and says, oh, let me look at that for a minute. And he comes back and he hands it to him, and he has the stones are gone. And it's just the silver ring. He said, that's worth like 3.5 pence. He needs 3.5 pence for it. And the kid says,
He doesn't want that. He wants the jewels.
He says, heck no. Give me back those jewels. Give me the full ring back, and I'll go somewhere else. So it's a pretty short case. Let me tell you a few little things that maybe aren't in your book. One is, so he was a climbing boy. This is a chimney sweep's climbing boy. This is a terrible job. You have to be a pretty small kid to do this. You are climbing into the chimneys to clean them out. These kids usually had very short lifespans, as you can imagine, because of what they're breathing in all day. They would have this, I think, to me, the most surprising thing about this case is somehow this kid has a lawyer. Right? And so he's very courageous to kind of, very bold of him to like walk into this fancy shop and try and get money for it. Now the somehow he finds a lawyer, and there's some people who argue that this might have happened because there's a lot of people who didn't like DeLaramie. He refused to pay his taxes. He's well known for like kind of being this like snotty guy who refused to pay his taxes. And so maybe that's why somebody, I still don't know how they found the lawyer, but that might be why a lawyer was willing to take this case. All right. Now, where did this ring come from? Who's the owner of this ring? Was it the chimney sweep kid? Was this his ring?
They couldn't determine the true owner, but he was the one that found it.
Yeah, so we have kind of something that we see in these cases where it's, we have a mysterious true owner. We don't know whose ring this, you know, what person actually originally, you know, had this ring and lost it. We just know that he found it. And that's true in a lot of these. And we see kind of this Latin phrase. I have no chalk. Jus tertii.
Again, let me destroy that for you. Right? That looks familiar. Right? And it's like, it's a rights in a third person.
So we're kind of acknowledging that the real owner is gone, and we're just trying to figure out the disputes between the people who are the current claimants, the people before the court. These cases are never about determining who the absolute owner is. The cases are just about who is the better owner between the two people who are currently before the court. The other thing we see here is that this is an action in trover. What does that mean?
It's for, like, the ring, right?
It's the opposite.
Oh.
And we can picture why, right? This kid is like, he's not really attached to this ring. He wants the money that he took it there to get sold. He wants the money. An action in trover is saying you just want the money value. And an action in replevin is saying you want the actual thing back. So if this ring was really special to you, and you wanted that ring, you would probably bring an action in replevin. Now this is a little bit different. These common law causes of action are a little different than we do today. Normally, you would have a cause of action where you would just say, I am the owner. And then in your kind of plea for relief, you would say either, I want the money or I want the thing. Here, you actually name what you want as your relief and then type in the cause of action. It mostly just to kind of make you aware of those terms when they pop up. So so somebody who wants, trover wants the damages for the conversion of personal property. Now, to get to prevail in an action of trover, the plaintiff has to show that they were the person who had a right to the property at the time of the conversion. So how can this little chimney sweep show that he is the rightful owner of this ring? What's his basis for ownership claim? Is it a receipt?
It's just the fact that he was through, like, his own doing. Like,
it's just his possession of it. It's just him finding it. Right? So this is the only thing he has to show, is that he is the one who found this item. And the court explains that a finder of lost property, has superior rights to anybody other than the true owner. So as the person who found it, and here we can see, Mr. Smith is starting to hint at, this is really rewarding for the first possession theory, right? Like, he's the one who found it. We're going to reward first possession. And so if anybody else comes up, his right will always be superior to that person. The only person who has a better right than him, the person who actually owned the ring. Now, that's not entirely true, because it could be somebody, maybe somebody found it before him or something like that. We could have a series of finders. So whoever found it before him. But the court kind of assumes that he found that it was lost by the true owner. All right, so the finder has such property as will enable him to keep it against all but a prior possessor. It might be better than against all but the true owner, would be a little bit better phrase. Okay, the Goldsmith here is vicariously liable for his apprentice's wrongdoing. Hopefully that's a phrase that you guys have seen before, right? Now, how do they calculate? Now, the jewel doesn't seem to be around, so how are they going to calculate how much damages this chimney sweep boy should get?
It's based on the jewel of the finest water.
Ooh.
How they determine, like, you know, how pure, like, how fine the jewel is.
Okay, why should we calculate damages that way? Normally, we put the burden on the plaintiff to show damages. Here, they seem to be switching that burden.
It'd probably be something to do with, like, custom. Is that how? Maybe that's how jewels
are. Yeah, so that's definitely how jewels are valued during that time. It was the water was like the clarity, right? So this is what they're really saying. If you can't produce those jewels that were in that ring, we are going to assume that they were the most expensive jewels. right? We're going to assume it was a diamond, not an opal, and you better give us the money for that value. Now, that is a different... Normally, we would think that actually the chimney sweep boy, the plaintiff making the claim, is the one who's going to have to demonstrate what his... He's trying to get damages. Normally, he would have to demonstrate what his damages are, and he would probably say, well, it was like a red and green stone. It was probably... So, but it's just a... we see here that they place the burden in a different place.
Peter, are you asking a question or like playing with your hair? Just doing your hair. Okay. All right. So here I think it's because they were clearly a wrongdoer. It wasn't just kind of this little bit of a dispute about who owns it and we're not sure and maybe both parties have decent claims. Right? It really is that they were kind of doing something nefarious by trying to trick this kid. So because they're wrongdoers, they make this burden a little bit heavier. Now, okay, so once the goldsmith pays the chimney sweep for the value of the jewels, now who owns the jewels? The goldsmith?
I would say because he...
Okay, right, so basically he's paid for it by paying him. Now, what happens if the true owner shows up? She shows up, she heard about this court case, saw the picture, realizes that it's her ring. Who does she bring an action against to try and get her ring back? So the goldsmith has it, the chimney sweep's got the money. Who should she be able to get her ring back from?
I don't know that she can. Because I guess like the chimney sweep didn't steal
What?
He didn't steal.
He didn't steal it, but his right to the property was better than anybody's except hers, right? She still has a better claim to the property.
Right, but then once he transfers it to the goldsmith, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think it's complicated. And notice this isn't adverse possession, right? If it was an adverse possession, we move into our next case as we talk about like how long she had it lost and without making a claim and stuff like that. But just in the realm of kind of the financial, well, most courts, or the courts in England at this time, would say that the goldsmith became the owner of the ring at that point. That this kind of this court case that settled the matter made the goldsmith the owner of the ring. But the landowner could go after the chimney sweep boy and get the money. That was the value of the ring. It's kind of messy. And it's not very clear. Some courts actually suggest that maybe she still could go to the goldsmith and get her ring back and he would like lose twice. But I don't think that that's I think that's a pretty small minority that kind of create that. So it's kind of I think she would have an action against the chimney sweep for the monies he received as a result, but she would really have lost that ring. Okay. Sorry. Excuse me. We also see this phrase bailment coming up here. I'll just introduce you. Do I have a slide? I'll just introduce you to this term, and we'll do the cases next time. These cases are short, so I think we can zoom through them pretty fast next class. But I just want to introduce you to the idea of bailment. Okay. Does anybody have a pen that I can borrow? All right. Thank you. All right. So bailment. What have I just become? A bailee, right? A bailee. Wait, who gave this to me? Lauren? No, okay. All right, and what is she? Bailor. She's the bailor. Okay, so what are my duties as a bailee? What do I have to do?
Not sell the property.
I can't sell this pen to anybody. $3. $3 pen. All right, what else? Yeah, Jesse?
Keep it safe and return it on the man.
Keep it safe. All right, so can I use the pen? What could I use it for?
What the owner would use it for?
Is that the right standard? What would you expect me to use this pen for you? Writing? Right? I think that's legitimate. What about can I point at people with it? Could I throw it at somebody who gave me an annoying question? No? All right, so the duty of care. Like, what is the duty of care that I have towards this pen? Like, what is my responsibility for how well I have to keep track of this pen? Under English law, there was like 6 different types of bailments. They were very complicated, and there was each as different standards like associated with each one. Now, the modern trend is to kind of just simplify things, and the duty of care is that of an ordinary person in similar circumstances. Right, so an ordinary person in similar circumstances means that I can write with this, I can take care of it, I can kind of walk around with my pen. Now, the question is, like, could I purposely destroy it? No, that would not have been, that would have breached our duty here, like my duty to care for her item. Now, but what if it just happened to run out of ink while I was using it? Would I have kind of breached my duty to care for this pen? Probably not. An ordinary person, ordinary use, if it just happened to be low on ink when she lent it to me, and so therefore it runs out of ink, I'm probably fine. Now, what if somebody else took this pen from me, like, so one of you rushes me and grabs this pen and, like, stomps on it? Then what? What should I do? It was in my care. Now, I would have, as the bailee, I would have the ability to go after that person in legal action. I could sue them for their damage to this property. As the bailor, she could also sue them as the true owner. So you can see that some of these cases we have about the finders of lost property, sometimes the court uses the term of bailee and bailor as an involuntary, like, if you find something of lost property, you find something that somebody loses, you are a bailee, but they were an involuntary bailor. They did not mean to lend it to you. Right? But it is now in your custody, within your safekeeping. And therefore, some courts will find that you can't just destroy it. You have kind of some duty of care to it until we can establish that enough time has passed that it should become yours. But in the meantime, in kind of this kind of middle area, that you have to some duties towards taking care of this item. What if I refuse to return this pen after I've kind of fulfilled the term? What could she sue me for? Conversion. Bailor can bring. And if successful, she could ask for either replevin and I give her the pen back, or she could ask for trover and I give her whatever the $3 that the pen is worth. Was this a voluntary or involuntary bailment? Voluntary. She thrust this pen upon me, right? So the laws of bailments actually, oddly, surprisingly, this is the last thing I'll tell you, surprisingly favor the bailees. And this is because the bailees are often the police. They are the most common people to be kind of in charge of people's lost property. And so we actually, it's usually we think we wouldn't value them so much, but because of that, we kind of have more rules kind of suggesting that the bailees have a little bit more leeway in what they're allowed to do with the property and what the standard of care should be. All right, we'll see these come up as we talk about our next cases. Thank you. Thank you.